Blog Talk Radio.
Online, on air. Online, on air.
Politics on the Navajo Nation.
Online, on air. Politics on the Navajo Nation.
You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, the world voice of Navajo politics. This is Cal Nez, and welcome everybody everywhere on the internet world, so to speak. Thank you for joining us this evening. We got some things that are on tap, and I'm looking forward to having a discussion. I am not sure if we're going to have a two-hour show. Right now I'm seeing it as a two-hour show, but we might just be cut off in about 30 minutes. But nonetheless, here we are, and there's a lot to cover this week, a lot of things happening on the Navajo Nation. This week is the Navajo Nation Council session, and they are going to be, I assume, probably going to be getting done on Friday, but they might get done a little earlier. So at this time, we have Ms. Marlee Shabala, who is online with us from Window Rock, Arizona. Marlee, what do you got on tap for us this evening?
Oh, Yat'e, Cal. This is Marlee Shabala. Kohe Glinia Shlom. And I'm actually still here in the Navajo Council chambers. And the council recessed until tomorrow. And it's sort of like, it's legislative term. They don't adjourn, they recess. The only time that they'll adjourn is when they're finished with their winter session agenda, which could be tomorrow or Friday, but the way things are going, it looks like they'll be going until Friday. They spent most of Monday on reports. They heard from President Ben Shelley's State of the Nation address, which was presented by Vice President Rex Lee Jim. And an interesting note in that State of the Nation address was that the Shelley Jim administration finally said that they support Navajo small businesses. And the vice president even said that small business was the backbone of the reservation economy. But many of the delegates said, but many of the delegates were disappointed. They said that that statement has come too late in the game with only 90 days left in the Shirley Jim administration. And so then the next day, And so the next day, Tuesday was the first day they actually take up legislation. And the first item that they went to was Navajo Housing Authority. And that was an override of President Shelley's veto of the council's legislation, which approved a different tribal designated entity, which means that federal housing funds wouldn't go to NHA, that it would go to the tribal housing program. It was interesting because it passed the council and then got vetoed by the president, and then when it came back for its override, it didn't pass. So the president's veto stands, and NHA will continue receiving federal housing funds. But throughout the council session, many of the delegates kept referring to how when they go to Washington, D.C. to ask for additional federal assistance, that congressional representatives will always bring up the, I think it's like how millions of dollars, I have 40 million that have not been spent, or even might even be more, I think it's more, that Navajo Housing Authority has not spent for several years. And in fact, the Inspector General for Housing ordered NHA to return $100 million that they haven't spent last year. So,
wow.
Yeah, what the council does is hard to explain or even kind of predict. They come in and you have no idea what they're going to do, and that's what happened with the legislation to remove council delegate as speaker. There was many of the council delegates who supported Speaker Nays wanted to immediately go to a vote without any kind of discussion. But under their floor rules, they're supposed to hear from the sponsor, which was Delegate Elton Shepherd. And Delegate Dwight Witherspoon called for a point of order and said that the council should be respectful and allow the sponsor to present his legislation. And that was allowed. And then they went to a long, long discussion about Speaker Nays, due process, and people were, it was good because people understood that council was not removing Delegate Nays as a delegate from the council, that it was about removing him as speaker because the criminal charges filed against him by the special prosecutor had created problems regarding another Navajo law, which was that any delegate who is sitting as speaker must be in good standing. And the delegate who asked for Mr. Nays' removal felt very strongly that he was no longer in good standing, that there were issues with the local state governments questioning the integrity of the council and the accountability, the trustworthiness because of their leader, which was Speaker Nays. And when it came down to a vote, they needed 16 yes votes, but it was 12 in favor and 11 opposed to remove Speaker Nays. And then they were going to go to the next legislation, which was to appoint a new speaker. And instead of going to that legislation, the Speaker Pro Tem, who was Edmund Yazzie, called for a recess, which was really unexpected, unusual. Still early in the day, but he went ahead and recessed the council and said there were problems with the recording equipment and other things. So the council came back in this morning and immediately took up that legislation, and they were on that most of the day because it dealt with a lot of technicality. And people just don't understand how these delegates can get really technical about their floor rules, and the attorneys don't help because the language they use sometimes confuses the delegates even more, and it was even more confusing to the individuals who were sitting in the gallery. And this council was, there was quite a few people sitting here listening and wanting to know what was going on with their council. And the there was a lot of issues regarding the appointment of a new speaker and whether or not legislation that is on the council agenda should go before the council instead of someone deciding that it's out of order and so, you know, it's going to be removed from the council and not respecting the council legislation and their agendas. And that was bottom line of the whole discussion and debate of what was happening here. And,
well, that's kind of interesting how the Navajo Nation Council first voted on the removal, and they basically defeated. But now they're talking about the appointment of the new speaker. How does that work out?
Well, it's legislation. That's what I mean. Any legislation that they approve for their agenda, they take up, and the only time that it can be removed from their agenda is by a 2/3 vote. And there's another way, too, where the speaker can rule legislation out of order only if the legislation is defective, meaning that if it deals with budget, that the budget is not attached. or that if the budget is attached, that there are no account numbers. And they've done that before. They've ruled legislation out of order, and they'll go to the next legislation. And that was the big debate is, okay, you know, here we have legislation. It went through the process. It's proper. And so if you want to remove it, it has to be done by two-thirds vote. But instead, the speaker ruled it out of order, and that was that's what created a lot of confusion and accusations of some of the delegates manipulating the council rules to get their way. But in the end, and that was even strange, they had to vote twice on Speaker Pro Tem's ruling that the legislation to appoint a new speaker was out of order. The first time he voted, and they felt that he shouldn't have voted because it was his ruling they were voting on, and the attorney said, yes, you know, you gave this question to the council, so you shouldn't be voting. So they re-voted again. But before they were going to re-vote again, they asked if Speaker Nay should vote, because now he wasn't the speaker, he was a delegate sitting on the floor. And then the attorney said, well, he has to decide if he's conflicted or not, and if he's conflicted, then he has to state why he's not going to vote. But Speaker Nay decided that he was not conflicted, even though the legislation was about his position as speaker, which a lot of the delegates felt was very, ethical. And that was something they talked about, too, when they went into recess. The Shiprock chapter passed a resolution asking the Attorney General about whether or not council delegates who are facing crimes against the Navajo Nation should step down. And Delegate Russell Begay clarified that question also by saying that it goes to whether or not a council delegate can vote on legislation when there is a conflict of interest. And the attorneys define conflict of interest as someone who would personally benefit from the vote or their business would benefit from the vote. And and you have council delegates on the floor who are also facing criminal charges like Speaker Nays. And so if they voted to remove him, it would be a confirmation that if you have criminal charges against you, you're not in good standing. And that was the issue, too, that I think many of the council delegates are feeling right now and talking about, is that some of these delegates, like Delegate David Tom, he's actually named in the complaint against Speaker Nays as one of those that conspired with him. And he went ahead and voted, and they brought that up. And this whole, with Speaker Nays choosing to remain as Speaker, his council is divided. Because the next legislation that came up, I mean, when they voted again, it was tie again, 10 to 10. And so they had to just stay with that vote because there was no one that could break the tie. And they went into the next legislation. And that one was interesting because that legislation was for the council to authorize a referendum for the people to vote on returning as the governing body of the Navajo Nation. The current law states that the Navajo Nation Council is the governing body, and that all powers not delegated by the people to the council shall be supervised by the council. And this new language with the referendum would have people voting on whether or not they wanted to return as the governing body of the Navajo Nation, and also retain powers over the powers that they had not delegated to the council. And that's what the legislation was. It just asked the council, authorize this referendum for the people to vote on this question. But the council saw that as a threat to them, to their powers. It was, I've seen this before since 2000 when the people brought legislation to reform the government, and the council nitpicked it until the Government Reform Commission just would not return the legislation. They were completely beaten down by the council questioning them and even questioning their integrity, and the council can get pretty harsh on employees, and especially when they see that these individuals are bringing legislation that threatens their power, which is actually not their power. It was power delegated by we the people to the council. In the end, they voted 8-8, 8 in favor and 8 opposed. And Speaker Nays was the deciding vote. And the individuals who voted for him to remain in office were the ones that opposed the referendum. And so he voted with them. And so in the end, the vote was 8 in favor and 9 opposed on authorizing a referendum for the people. And one of the council delegates said that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that particular legislation, which is basically advocating that the power goes back to the people, and so that is now gone, and it's a dead issue.
Yeah, it's a dead issue, and if it I have to applaud Delegate Jonathan Mez, who was the sponsor of that legislation, because he knew the history of similar legislation that's come before this council, the previous council, the councils before that. And each time that the council is asked to authorize a referendum for the people to vote on reforming their government, the council brings up all kind of reasons not to approve it. I mean, there was at a morning discussion before the council session, Delegate Catherine Benally actually accused Jonathan Nez of sponsoring this legislation to become popular with the people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and so.
Well, Marlene, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to have you remain on the line and. Because there's a lot of things that I'd like to kind of discuss with you in reference to this week's Navajo Nation Council, some of the dynamics of the voting, and, of course, this removal of the speaker is a huge issue. And I've read on Facebook that there's people out there, you know, very vocal about it. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to have you... hang on the phone, and I'll bring you back in a few minutes, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Okay, people out there, you are listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. This is Cal Nez, your host, and thanks for dialing in. And I would like to proceed and bring our featured guest this evening, who is calling in from our nation's capital. And I appreciate the opportunity that she has taken the time to call us really at about 9 o'clock, or no, maybe it's 10 o'clock her time. And that's Clara Pratt, and we'll get some more details on the operations of her office. And if you have any questions for the Washington office and see how they do monitor legislation and what they do back in their office in Washington, D.C., how it affects the Navajo Nation, Navajo people, and that sort of thing, and how often that they're in contact with the office of the president, and who do they answer to? Is it the Navajo Nation Council, or is it the Navajo Nation President's office? I'd like to welcome Ms. Clara Pratt. Yate Clara.
Yate Cal, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Hello. Yo, you can hear me. Yate Cal, it's good to be here. She'e Clara Pratt and she Kiani Bashishin. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you very
Hello.
Well.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Cal. I'm so sorry about that. For some reason, I'm on a mobile phone, so I'm getting some odd feedback. I'm from Lupton, Arizona, and I'm the executive director of the Navajo Nation Washington office. And I have full disclaimer, I'm not on the East Coast right now. I'm actually in Navajo Nation capital of Winter Rock, Arizona, also here for the council session that Marley was discussing just a few moments ago.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're actually all on the same time frame. I am just curious what your coverage of the Navajo Nation Council is this week, and what your affiliation is there this week.
Oh, sure. Well, I often come back for council sessions. As you know, the council takes up many pieces of legislation that will affect what the nation does on a federal, national level. So I always have a great interest in that, great interest in following along with what the decisions they're making here, of course. And just to follow on with what you had stated in your opening introduction there, who we answer to and all that good stuff. But the Navajo Nation of Washington office is by statute, or by code rather, an intergovernmental office, meaning although we're organized under the executive office of the Office of the President and the Vice President, we work closely with all three branches in serving the needs legislatively, federally of the Navajo people.
Okay. Wow. So tell us a little bit more about, where your office is and located, how many staff you have, and just some of the general particulars.
Sure. Well, the office was really formally created in 1983 under the leadership at that time when they saw that there was a real need to have a government-to-government relationship between the Navajo Nation and the federal government at the D.C. level. And at that time, prior to that time, the Navajo Nation was doing what a lot of tribes do today. They hired lobbyists and attorneys and things like that to represent their needs on specific issues. So they looked at the economics of it, and they realized that they could probably do a better lobbying effort with tribal government employees that were charged with this advocacy or this lobbying. So the office began with very humble beginnings, one or two folks just running it on a part-time basis, renting space from different other national offices that were there, and then formally opening in 1983 and starting up with at first three employees to now what we have today is a total of 10 different employees, many of whom are attorneys or policy majors that go and advocate on very specific issues to Congress, to Capitol Hill, to federal agencies on behalf of the Navajo Nation.
So give us an example of on a daily basis, how often are you in contact with the Navajo Nation?
Every day, honestly, every single day, we're in contact with some portion of the Navajo Nation. So typically we deal on a day-to-day basis with program offices, division directors, the Office of the President. Even on the legislative side, we have to make recommendations to council to either, introduce resolutions that support or suggest specific legislative language that we then lobby on behalf of the nation to different members of Congress to benefit the nation in some way.
Okay. You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. And all you listeners out there, if you have any questions for Ms. Pratt, you're welcome to call in. And the telephone number here is 347-989-0048. Again, this is Politics on the Navajo Nation. And again, I want to thank you for being with us here, Ms. Pratt, that you're able to share some insight about how your office works. Now, in terms of legislation on the national level, you got Congress, you got the Senate, and of course you got the Office of the President back there. How do you go about monitoring legislation affecting the Navajo Nation? Does the federal government contact you, or do they contact the Navajo Nation? And how exactly does that relationship work?
It happens in a variety of ways. There's no one set prescribed way, and a lot of it is really about relationship building. So we encourage our associates build really strong relationships with their counterparts, both the agencies and on Capitol Hill, so that they can talk to them on a regular basis, that different staffers feel comfortable calling our office, or we have meetings every so often, daily, weekly, depending on the issue. And then, of course, we have to monitor very actively the legislation that affects the Navajo Nation that you may not automatically assume would affect the Navajo Nation. And a good example of that is, you know, in some aspects there might be a particular piece of legislation that seeks to modify thresholds for government contracting. Now, on the face of it, you wouldn't think that would have anything to do with the Navajo Nation. It doesn't have anything specific about tribal or Indian affairs. However, it's our job to analyze that piece of legislation, and in further analysis, we might see, oh, that particular piece would have an effect on our enterprises that are doing government contracting. Or another good example is one of our associates, Brian Quint, who's one of our very talented associates in the Washington office. He was reviewing some of the budget language that recently passed, and it very clearly within the budget language it said for forward-funded programs this would, you know, create an issue. And on the face of it, you wouldn't think that would be a problem, but the Navajo Nation does have many forward-funded programs, and we sought to get clarification to ensure that it, once it became enacted into law, it wouldn't affect tribal programs. So sometimes legislation has unintended consequences, and it's our job to make sure that we're on the lookout for that, we're correcting it, we're fixing it before it becomes a problem.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Again, for all those listeners out there, you're welcome to call us in, and we do have a caller, several callers. Would you mind taking any calls, Clara?
Yes, please.
Okay. I hope you don't mind me calling you Clara as well.
Oh, call me Clara.
Okay. All right. Caller, you are on the air, and there's a lot of feedback, so can you please turn your sound down or something? Caller, do you have a question for Ms. Clara Flack? Okay, caller, I've got another caller on, and do you have a question for Ms. Pratt?
Hello?
Yes, hello. You are on air right now with Politics on the Navajo Nation and myself and also Clara Pratt. Do you have a question?
Hello. Is this Cal? This is Darlene.
Yes, it is.
I called in at one time. Okay. I wanted to ask Clara if, okay, we have an issue with the confluence, and there is a legal binding federal law called the Intergovernmental Hopi Navajo Compact. So this law is supposed to protect both tribes and their religious sites and what they consider their sacred sites. I'm trying to figure out or trying to find out why the Navajo Nation or the president himself is not abiding or does not have the respect to abide by these laws that are made by the Navajo Nation government with the federal government.
Okay. Ms. Pratt, can you respond to that, please?
Sure. You know, and I can't speak, you know, as a specific, but there is a compact, which is the Intergovernmental Navajo Hopi Compact. And you're right, it does outline for sacred sites. It also does not disallow for the purposes of development, different pieces of development that might occur. So if you read the compact, and I would encourage you to do that, you can do that on indianaffairs.gov. And if you, you know, look, do a search for the Navajo Hopi Compact, you can read through that. And it clearly does not say that the president in the activity of supporting development is in violation of any sort of law. It does say access to and use of certain places and natural resources are essential to the traditional religious practices of the Navajo Hopi people. You know, the question of development is not an easy question. And I know that the president and others in the administration do not want to violate anybody's right to certain places or natural resources or certainly hinder traditional religious practices. However, we do have to balance the desire and the want of community members and people in those communities that wish to see development, that want to bring development into certain places, but still do so in a very respectful way. And listening to the will of the people is what we must do as public servants. But again, you know, that there isn't anything that the president has undertaken that would be in violation of that compact. And if you're interested, folks that are listening, to read what that compact says, I would encourage you to go to indianaffairs.gov and you can find it in a PDF format there.
Okay. Darlene?
I have another question. Yes. I understand where you're coming from. The thing with this is, like you said, the respect for the people. And if it is for the people, which is, I feel the same way. I understand that part of it. But I think there are certain businesses, big corporate businesses, that want to just come in and make money off the backs of the Navajo people. But in actuality, they don't help these people. They take away what they say they're going to give to them. And when you come in and you just take upon yourself to take what you think you deserve or feel you have a right to take, but you do not include the people, when you do not include the people, that's where I have an issue with. That's the problem that we have right now. We were never informed as permit holders that this was even in the process. We did not have Lamar Whitmer come to us, to the community, or even to the grazing permit holders in that area and tell us this was going to happen way ahead of time. They did not even ask us if we wanted this. The community did not know anything about this at all. That is my issue, is that when you do that to people and you just take away from them their very way of life, the way that they have lived for years and hundreds of years, and you just take it out from under them and just say, well, yeah, I'm building you a business where you're going to work at, which is a lie, because that does not actually happen. These people are not going to be the ones getting the job. And this person that has come in and saying, I'm going to give you a job, he's wrong, because we know that there are other corporations, other businesses that will be coming in also. They will be doing the hiring. They're not going to be hiring the people that are old or the people that don't know what's going on. They have to be skilled workers. They have to be educated in certain fields. And that's an outright lie. So that's where my issue is.
Okay. Here's the question, is that, all the callers, please keep in mind that, we have an office in Washington, D.C., and, of course, on a national level, how the communication between the Navajo Nation and these outside entities and also the Washington office, what are going to be the protocols? I guess those are kind of the steps. Is your question, Darlene. I think that, how is it that we're going to disseminate information from the localized level to the Washington area? If you wouldn't mind addressing that, Clara, maybe these issues don't really affect your office, but more of the central government in Window Rock.
Well, thank you, Callum. Thank you, Darlene, for your comments. I do think they affect us all, honestly, frankly, because I feel very much how she feels on this issue, and I don't disagree with you, Darlene. I do think that there is a history of corporate interests taking advantage of the people. I absolutely 100% hear where you're coming from. I think that in this particular case, in this particular interest, you do have community support for this type of development. And it's really important that the community is the one that asked for this. It's not a top-down approach. We didn't come in and say, hey, this is what you're going to have. And yes, there's private developers involved and things of that nature. But there, in any type of development, you're going to get people that are not happy with the development itself or not supportive. And in that case, really have a division of the community itself. And that's really hard to manage. That's really hard to try to mitigate. But I don't agree that it's something that's being thrust upon or pushed upon. It's not 100% done thing. This is not something that central government is forcing on anybody. It's something that has to be considered. It has to be done with transparency. And it's not only issues like the one that Darlene brings up, but it's all sorts of issues that we have to deal with. And it eventually does make its way to a national level, whether that's a water rights negotiation or sacred sites negotiation. And sometimes we're on the same page and sometimes we're on a different page, but the important thing is that we can come together as a community to debate the pros and cons and to respectfully listen to all the thoughts that are on the table and then to leave it to the people to decide with the understanding that if the majority of the people go one way, you can't discount that because, you know, there are those that do not agree with it. So there are some issues, and I'm definitely sensitive to those things, and I think the administration is definitely sensitive to those
things. Well, I
appreciate that.
Okay.
Hello?
Well, that sounds good, and Darlene, I appreciate you calling in and asking those questions, and I'm sure that, there's got to be a dialogue somewhere along the line that needs to happen, whether it's central government, local, or Washington level. So I appreciate that caller. And we also have another caller on the phone right now. You said hello, and we could hear you.
Hello.
Welcome. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do, Clara. My name is Pauline Martin Sanchez. I live in, my business is in Mesa, Arizona, but I am also from the reservation, the area that Darlene Martin has shared with you, the situation with the proposed luxury resort that's going to be built there. I've had the opportunity to have Lamar Whitmer approach me. He also has brought Washington people that work there in Washington to come and solicit my support for the development. And when I reviewed all the information, their brochures, the financial printout, the map of the site, I've had it, looked at by those who know where the sections are located. And also having received supporting resolutions from different chapters and from the Medicine Men Association and from the Hopi Nation themselves and the Grand Canyon, who has also received more than once this proposal to build a gondola down into the Grand Canyon and has been refused again and again. As I stood in my opposition to it, the picture of my home, my address, and a defamation statement by Mr. Albert Hale was printed on a newsletter and sent to about 4,000 homes on the Navajo Reservation. This is not a, my question is, what is the procedure that I need to go to get this defamation and their newsletters off their website that endangers, I had grandchildren living with me when they put it on, and the legal procedure that I need to go through to have them take the picture of my home, to take that defamation statement that misrepresents me and causes harm to my reputation, trust in the community that I have brought many services to, and also as a parent of the year from the state of Arizona, and my business, all those things kind of, their statement, their picture, the things that they have done, to me as an individual, like putting every all of the blame on me, has caused great trouble. So it's
okay.
Not,
so Clara, can you
how,
give
you know, you're saying do it respectfully. You're saying doing it, you know, to do it respectfully, but the conference partners, Mr. Hale, who was the former president of United of the Navajo Nation, has not done it in a respectful way, and have and have defamed my reputation.
Okay, let's give her a chance to answer that. Okay, Clara.
Well, you know. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Cal, this is really that's a legal question, and not something that, you know, I could answer for her. However, I would say that this issue is not between the issue, the matter that she's bringing up is not between the Navajo Nation and this private individual person. It's a private company and this individual person that's called in. So that being said, I wouldn't be able to assist her in any way. But I would say that if this is of concern to her, she ought to seek legal counsel about that issue.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that. And, and callers, please keep in mind that, please relay your questions that are concerning the Washington office. And I do appreciate that call. And I know that there are concerns, and we might even just put another show on that specifically is addressing the dynamics of conducting business on the Navajo Nation, in whatever region of the Navajo Nation. It looks like we need to address that. So, again, callers, thank you very much. And we have another caller that I'm going to bring online right now. Caller, you are on air. It looks like a 928-380 number. Hello, caller. Do you have a question?
Right now, I'm just listening, Cal. This is Francis.
Okay.
One of the, let me ask Claire this one question. Claire, one concern that I have is with Navajo offices about the 638 healthcare centers. Every year, the Navajo Nation goes down there with their position paper. Why is there a delay in funding for health facilities, especially in the Southwest area? Can you give us a timeline about we get a position paper from our chapter and everything else, but when it comes down to traveling down to D.C. with it, the Navajo Department of Health gets a bigger chunk of file they take as a position paper. How do you interpret that? Is there a way that you can probably work with Navajo? You work with Navajo Nation, but we need to stand firmly on that position that we do need that health care center. It's been 40 years, and that's too long for health to be brought to the Southwest area.
Okay, I appreciate that. Clara?
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that comment, and it's very timely, actually, because it's not only in healthcare that we have a lot of funding delays, it's across the Navajo Nation government. And it's really an underlying issue, and it's a timely question that you bring up. I'm sure that some of you listening on the show saw the President's State of the Union last night on President Obama's State of the Union last night on television. And one of the issues that continually gets brought up for the last several years is the fact that Congress does not enact a full budget till well into the fiscal year. And unfortunately, that affects us greatly. So if the budget does not get enacted, you know, the fiscal year starts October 1, and if the United States government, through Congress and sign off by the President, does not enact a budget until January, February, March, April, sometimes later, we don't get that money until much, much delayed, which means that the programs at the Navajo Nation have to very quickly spend that as fast as they can, to distribute it as fast as they can, and it creates a great hardship and a bottleneck in the whole system, again, not just for health and contract, but across the board, whether that's transportation dollars, energy, water, interior, and the whole act of spending. Now, for this last budget, it was just passed last week for fiscal year 14. Well, we're already how many months into fiscal year 14? So that means that we, again, have this bottleneck delay. And as for the position papers, I actually get to see all those, so they don't just disappear into nothing. The central here consolidates all of those position papers, those funding requests, those facilities requests, and they come across to our desk, and we get to see them. So your work and the work that you put into those is very much appreciated, and they don't fall on deaf ears. They're necessary and they're needed so that we understand how best to advocate for you. And the good news about this last budget was that the IHS budget was held pretty much harmless, which is really good news as we're talking about budget cuts and things of that nature. Now, for those of you who are interested in the budget, you'll probably know that the first week of February, President Obama's fiscal year 15 budget is due to Congress, and then through March, April, May, into the summer, they'll be holding hearings. At those hearings, the President, President Shelley, or other directors, depending on the program, will travel to D.C., and they'll provide in-person testimony in front of House Financial Services, the House Committee on Appropriations, the Senate Committee on Appropriations. And that's where we use the information that we get from all over the Navajo Nation, from all the different programs, to develop that testimony so that he can advocate for you using the numbers and the data that is provided. And once that happens, they hopefully pass a fiscal year budget, you know, knock on wood, by October 1 of this year. But as we've seen for the last several years, they don't usually do that until much later. So I hope that's a long-winded way of answering your question of why there's such a delay and the tough position that the Navajo Nation gets put in when Congress doesn't do its job in a timely fashion.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And callers, thank you very much for calling in. We've got several callers also waiting right now. And caller, it's an Arizona number. Do you have a question for Ms. Clara Pratt?
Yes. My name is Joanne Chissy. I have a question about, in terms of legislation that is now introduced to the Navajo Nation Council, about ethical and human rights issues. I'd like to know how you monitor everything that's happening and what exactly are your thoughts about the ethical violations now that they've now introduced about Speaker Nazy, and since they've decided not voted against his removal, how does your office actually... Are you all able to regulate, like, you know, what's happening or step in as to the charges that are pending against him? And another question I had, I'm sorry, but you're
okay.
Talking about...
One question at a time, Joan.
Okay.
Let her answer that
okay.
question, then we'll get to that other question.
Hi, Joan. Let me try to answer that the best way I can. Our office does not have any involvement in that process. We don't, you know, as you said, step in. Our function and role is to really respect the Navajo Nation governmental process. We take our direction from the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. And, you know, we wait to see the outcomes just like anybody else does. So we don't get involved in those issues per se, but we do keep abreast of what's occurring on the Navajo Nation. We have a very open communicative process with all the branches, and we get the distribution as to what's in the comment period, what's coming down, what we can expect to see. And likewise, we also suggest to the legislative branch what pieces of the legislation will help us advocate for the Navajo people.
Okay. I have another question. With the BHP mine purchase, there are EPA regulations that are in place right now, and there's a Navajo Nation EPA and then a U.S. federal EPA. What directly oversees the actual laws that would prohibit or actually help them to execute such purchases. How does the U.S. EPA get involved?
Okay. I was getting a little bit of feedback there, Joan, but I think you were asking how U.S. EPA gets involved and how such purchases are regulated. And that's a very good question. The U.S. EPA has some oversight, as does Department of Interior, Office of Surface Mining, Bureau of Land Management. All these different federal entities have some role to play in the procurement of this complexity. The Navajo Nation EPA has assumed some of the U.S. EPA's roles and functions. And the way they're able to do that is that the Navajo EPA standards actually in some instances exceed federal standards, which is a good thing for our environment here on the Navajo Nation. So in order for this purchase to be finalized, there's a variety of steps that have to happen, including compliance with all federal regulations, compliance with environmental regulations. Before anything occurs, full environmental assessments have to occur. So it's not simply a matter of the Navajo Nation buying a mine and operating it and that's that. There's a whole bunch of hoops that we have to jump through to ensure that we're complying with every environmental standard that we have to.
Joan?
Yes. So if the EPA has standards, the Navajo Nation has standards, and the Navajo Nation is not actually purchasing the mine, NTEC is purchasing the mine, how does that affect how your office creates a need for compliance?
Well, my office doesn't create the compliance. The compliance comes into place by the federal standards that are there. So you're absolutely right.
You're a mediator. You're the mediator, right, between all of these entities from there? Or how
Correct.
Does that work? How does your office fit in all of this?
Well, what we would do is we would work with the various agencies that have oversight over this process, and we would work really closely with Navajo EPA to ensure that all the standards are met, to ensure that every environmental standard is met. We don't ensure that, but the compliance portion comes into place by EPA and US EPA.
Okay, so knowing that the BHP mine is the only thing that purchased and not the actual plant, where does that put the EPA in this purchase?
Well, let's say, for example, let's take it off reservation, just to simplify it. Let's say there's a mine there, and instead of a tribe, it's a private entity, which it is in this case. It's NTEC, but NTEC is a wholly owned corporation of the Navajo Nation, so it gets a little bit complicated that way. But let's say a private company comes in to buy a mine somewhere, anywhere. Let's say Indiana. They come in to buy a mine. In order for that mine to get purchased by a new entity, the EPA would have to come in and ensure that the new owners, the new operators, are in full compliance with the law. And they would have to ensure that whoever's selling the mine is not selling, you know, a big environmental problem. So the previous owners of the mine can't just unload an environmental catastrophe and say, well, the other people are going to buy it. You know, all these checks and balances have to come into place. Now imagine that same process happens here. The only thing that makes it different is that it's on Indian land, so there's a couple of even more robust standards that we have to adhere to. And on top of that, NTEC is owned wholly by the Navajo Nation, so other federal entities get involved. So it's not a straight business-to-business transaction that's just, you know, swift through. There's more complicated pieces, but the same standards environmentally have to be complied with.
Wow. I appreciate that. And Joan is still on the phone, and we'll get back to her. But, Clara, I'm also going to put you on hold. I've got another segment here that I do called Newsflash, and I'll get so if you wouldn't mind, can you hold on?
Sure, no problem.
Okay, I appreciate that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've been waiting for this evening as well, and for this caller to call in, and we have a newsflash by Mr. Bill Donovan. Bill.
Cal, one of the most frequent questions I have been asked over the past 4 years has been, when will the Navajo Nation's special prosecutors file charges against former tribal president Joe Shirley Jr. for his role in the BDCS and ONSAT scandals? After all, that was the reason why the special prosecutors were hired in the first place back in 2009. But instead of doing this, the special prosecutors seem to have taken all their time going after tribal council delegates for mismanagement of the tribe's discretionary fund program. Well, the good news is that those who have been waiting for the Joe Shirley ball to fall probably won't have to wait much longer. The word is that the special prosecutors will be making an announcement in the very near future on this issue. But it may not be the one that opponents against Joe Shirley want to hear. If you've been keeping in touch with the tribe back in 2009, you'll remember that the council and Shirley did not get along very well. The council even illegally put him on administrative leave for a while during that time. But there were members of the council who were adamant that Shirley's involvement in these two controversies cost the tribe millions of dollars, and that the owners of these two businesses were able to do what they did because of Shirley's influence. As you may remember, the BCDS scandal centered around a man named Hak Han, who convinced the tribe to give him a loan of more than $2 million to create a business in Shiprock that manufactured products for the Defense Department. The tribe later learned that the man used most of that money to pay for things like gambling debts and boats. The ONSAT controversy centered around another man named Dave Stevens, who had a contract to develop broadband internet in the chapters and Head Start. But most of the stories around him concerned his travels around the world with Shirley in tow as he tried to convince the Navajo, as he tried to convince the United Nations to use his program on the Navajo Reservation as a model for similar programs in the Third World countries. His contract came under question because of allegations he was overcharging the tribe by hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that Shirley was somehow involved in getting him this money. Shirley has consistently denied any wrongdoing in either of these matters. In fact, he says his office had nothing to do with the BDCS matter at all. That was all done by the Shiprock chapter. Instead, he and his supporters have argued that the investigation against him was nothing more than bitter tribal politics and was created by members of the council to get back at him for pushing government reform. The interesting thing about all this is that all the stories that were written in the press about these two matters, there was not one single piece of story in any of them that implicated Shirley in any wrongdoing. There were just only the allegations. So we will have to see soon whether the special prosecutors came up with anything to charge Shirley with. My guess is that they didn't. This is Bill Donovan with a newsflash from the Navajo Reservation.
The head, the whole.
You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation with Claire Pratt from the Washington office for the Navajo Nation. I appreciate everybody who's here with us. If you guys have any question, you're welcome to call what the Washington office does. And the telephone number is 347-989-0048. Again, 347-989-0048. And I appreciate Clara being with us. So she's actually calling in from Window Rock, Arizona. I think you've been sitting in on all the council session, right, Clara?
That's right.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Well, we have another caller who is on the phone right now. Caller, do you have a question for Ms. Pratt? Hello, caller. I can hear you. The telephone number is 619-392. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, Kel. I didn't know I was on. Hey, Kel, are you there?
Yeah, is this Lorenzo Robbins, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know what?
You're live on air right now, so do you have a question for Ms. Pratt?
Okay. I missed a part of the show, but anyways, till then, I got, just start out with a couple questions if nobody's... on the mine purchase, this hopefully does not turn into like a General Motors... where the taxpayers at the end actually lost as the owner of, General Motors, and then they dumped the stock at the end. With Navajo Mine, is that going to play, if it plays out like that, what would the result be?
Clara?
Okay. Thankfully, that's not going to be the case, and I say that with the utmost confidence because the due diligence that had to go into the acquisition of this magnitude was very, very robust. It's not something that the nation and our leadership took lightly, and it was something that they demanded very, very, very detailed financial data, market trend analysis, et cetera, on. And I have to say I'm really proud of our Navajo Nation leadership, which is, unfortunately not a lot of what I'm hearing based on some of the comments I've heard. However, I have to say I'm very proud of them. They went into this with open eyes, several work sessions, and a lot of very high-paid analysis to get to the point that where we're at. And, I can say with full faith and certainty that your fear, which I've heard, I don't feel that that's the case in this situation.
Lorenzo.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have more callers calling, Kel? I mean, I'm not going to hog up the time.
Yes. Okay. Yes, there is. So I appreciate that, Lorenzo. And thanks for the reply, Clara. And I'm also going to... I guess Joan is not really done with us, so I'm going to bring Joan back. She's calling back in. Joan, do you have another question for Ms. Pratt?
Yes, I could come up with more questions. I'm going to reference the 2013 energy policy. And the Navajo Nation Council recently passed it as law, but some offices claim it to be policy and some claim it to be law. What are your thoughts? how does the Navajo Nation officers, do you guys monitor that, you know, the energy
sure.
policy? And
yeah, let her answer
sure.
that, Joan.
Well,
okay.
It's authorizing legislation, so it is policy. There's nothing in the policy that actually, you know, legislates an action or directs or anything like that. But it's an overall policy and a framework. And, you know, I'm not sure how much you know about the background of it, but the Navajo Nation's energy policy was extremely outdated, and the energy policy was the brainchild of President Ben Shelley, who really, in his work in the council and then as vice president, saw a need to update that energy policy because of the voice of the Navajo people saying, you know, we're no longer just a natural resource coal economy base anymore. We want to get into these other areas of energy development. We want to be on the cutting edge of technology. So in his first few months in his administration, you know, he brought together national laboratories and said, hey, let's look at our resources. The people want us to look at diversifying our natural resource interests, and we need an energy policy to help us do that. And the energy policy, from my perspective, what we'll end up using it for from the Washington, D.C. level, is a good example is Congressman Don Young from Alaska. He has been pushing an Indian energy policy, if you will, or statute. And it's helpful if we have something on our end that tells Congress what we want, so we're not simply waiting for them to dictate to us. We're being self-governing, we're being sovereign, and we're saying, this is what we care about, this is what our people have said, and the energy policy does that. And I was very pleased that the council finally, you know, implemented that and passed that, because it helps us in a lot of ways. And one of the other things that I wanted to quickly address before we get a little too far down the line was I heard Ms. Shabala bring up the how we finally, the Navajo Nation government finally became pro-business. Well, I just wanted to remind Ms. Shabala and Cal, you were actually there. In January 2011, you know, President Ben Shelley came into office. And just a few months later, in April 2011, held a business leaders roundtable. And that was the first time a president had ever done that, had actually sat down and listened to area Navajo businessmen and women and said, what is it that you need? And he said in that address, small businesses are the backbone of any economy. So I would contest and debate the point that we finally brought it up, because the fact of the matter is, of stated record, since April 2011, that's been President Shelley's platform. And since before that, I mean, he was a small business owner, reservation-based himself, and he knows very well the issues that face small businesses and the hurdles that face small businesses. And he brought me on board to tap into my expertise in some of those areas as well. So, you know, I just wanted to address that really quickly. But, you know, to go back to Joan's point, yeah, there's things that the policy will actually affect us on the federal level as well.
And looking at the framework of the energy policy, you see several components, and one of them is that the net fundamental law and how they're supposed to integrate the Navajo Nation Medicine Men's Association. And that being only policy, how does that affect the human rights issue? And I'm thinking in the United Nations Human Rights Assessment, how does that affect what your office does with everything that's happening here?
Well, and that's a really good question. The Navajo Nation has been very involved in the declaration, the UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights. Vice President Jim, in his work both on the council and as the vice president, was instrumental working on the declaration prior to when it even became adopted by the United States government. So including that in the energy policy was very important for the Shelley Jim administration, because they feel very strongly that without protecting the human rights and the social justice rights, you cannot have a policy. If you negate where you're from, you're not going to know where you're going. So the energy rights, the energy policy takes into account the social justice issue. And so what we have to do now is, in the implementation of that policy, ensure that the tenets of that policy are adhered to, and ensure that the Medicine Men's Association is, in fact, involved and instrumental in everything that we do moving forward with the energy policy.
So do you all become involved when it is human rights issues? How does that work?
Well, we do become involved. We work really closely with the administration. We are part of the administration, and we're very supportive of the Human Rights Office here in Winter Rock and the work they undertake, submitting testimony before the United Nations on human rights violations and issues. And then another important component is working with the NGOs that are on the Navajo Nation and making sure their voices and concerns are heard in the process of public hearing, legislation, and that sort of thing.
Human Rights Assessment is basically for the economical, political, and social aspects for the tribe, how does one get involved from your office at that level? Especially when it has political issues and social issues and people feel that their rights have been violated because the Navajo Nation government doesn't actually consider what the people say. They do not go back to the people and include them when they make these decisions. And these decisions are with deciding millions and millions of dollars of the people's money. So really they don't have a way to let the people speak when they want to address these issues. How does your office help with all of this?
Well, I just want to clarify. Our office is a part of the Navajo Nation government. So what I'm hearing you saying is the government itself is not listening to human rights violations. And I would respectfully disagree, but I certainly hear where you're coming from. Navajo Nation government, like many governments, is a representative government made up of elected leadership. There's the Human Rights Commission. There are all these entities in place to safeguard those issues. My office is an arm of the Navajo Nation government, advocating for the Navajo Nation's interests. And by that way, advocating for the Navajo people's interests in as much as they've elected their leadership to represent them. So I hear a lot of concern and debate by different folks in different communities. And I think it's not uncommon, not only on the Navajo Nation, but in any community, you're going to get differing and dissenting opinions and views. But I just wanted to clarify that the Navajo Nation Washington office is not an intermediary or a mediator between the Navajo government and its own people. We are a part of the Navajo government representing the Navajo Nation's interests in our nation's capital.
So essentially, all of the legislation, the laws, and whatever they may be, starts at the chapter level and works its way up to Window Rock, and then on to Washington D.C. if it goes that far, and onto the national level, right?
Right, national and even international. Like what Joan was bringing up was the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And Navajo Nation leadership was very involved in ensuring that the United States, implemented that. So it's kind of interesting the dynamic between people who feel disenfranchised by their own government and yet that same government feeling disenfranchised by a bigger government via the Fed and trying to advocate for its people. So it's a really interesting dynamic, and I think it's one that deserves a lot of study and thought because, it's something that you hear a lot of, this disenfranchisement with one's own government, and how do you correct that? How do you become less disenfranchised? You ensure that you're voting. You ensure that you're getting people into these elected positions that have the same values and thought systems that you do.
Yeah, that's a very... That's a very interesting dynamic right there that you bring up, where you've got, not very happy people here on the Navajo Nation, or at least you've got an impression, but also on a national or if not the international level, you got the same feeling coming from the different tribes. So that's very interesting. Let's have another caller on the phone. Caller, do you have a question for Ms. Pratt? Hello, you are live on air, 928-380. Can you hear me?
Yes. I hear you, Cal. This is Francis, still online. I have another question for him. The question is, since you collaborate with the Navajo Nation at the Navajo office, what is your take on the Navajo Department of Health? Again, from our chapter, we have Winslow Service Unit again. The eight chapters that are being supported by the Winslow Union Healthcare Corporation, the chapters they opposed it, saying that the Navajo Nation, the Navajo Health of Division of Health, needs to leave our healthcare alone. Why? What is your stand, and how do you picture the Navajo Department of Health being enacted?
Okay.
Well, that's a complicated question. That's a complicated question, but I think it's one that, you know, that should be talked about. Part of a lot of the issues, and again, not just related to health, but you see it in the education arena as well. And part of the issue is that the Navajo Nation in its current existence was not something that we as Navajo people said this is how we want a government to run. Modeled based out off of Western thought and theory on how a government should be structured. And sometimes I say it's a little bit like putting a round peg in a square hole. Sometimes pieces don't quite fit. And the Navajo Nation government, central, as a lot of people call it, is stuck in the unfortunate position of trying to navigate local governance, contracts, 93-638, in the case of education, public school systems, charter school systems, decentralization, the chapters, the 110 and the 34 or some odd now that are LGA certified. And there's been a real effort made over the last 4 or 5 years for decentralization, giving the government back to the people. Now, that's all well and good, but we have to interface with a federal entity in a lot of these instances. And the federal entities, a lot of times, don't know how we operate, or they don't quite understand how we operate. You know, a good example is I was sitting in a meeting and with a staffer who I will not name, and they said, well, I don't understand why you give so much control to these chapters. Why can't you just take it and do it? And that, for me, really kind of blew my mind, and it just spoke the whole situation of how people don't understand how we operate. And I explained and I said, you see that as a bad thing. I see local control as a good thing. Why on earth would the nation say, no, that's just how we're going to do it? I mean, we get accused of that all the time, but that's really not what we want to do. And you know, I can say in a lot of instances, it would be a lot easier, but it's not the way we want to operate. It's not the way we should operate. And it's not the way the people want us to operate. So when you ask me about how do I feel about the health, Division of Health, Department of Health, I think it's important. It has an essential government role. But we need to be really careful how we implement that and to ensure that the local control is in place.
Yeah, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. This is Cal Nev. This is your only opportunity, listeners out there, if you can call in, if you have any questions for Ms. Clara Pratt, which is from the Navajo Nation Washington office. And I want to thank her again for taking the time out to share some of the information. I really am thankful because I think these are the type of shows that we need to talk about or get engaged in and have a discussion. It doesn't take any more than a telephone call that we have her online right now. So we have another caller. Caller, you are on the phone. Do you have a question?
Hello? Hello?
Yes, you're on. Yes, you are on. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question on the purchase of the mine that we've been talking about. I have heard the rumor, and I couldn't substantiate this, but the money that was purchased by somebody had mentioned to me that it was the same company that was selling the mine back to the Navajo tribe. I'm just curious if Claire knows where, how we got the financing to purchase that mine.
Okay, Clara.
Cal, could you repeat that? I couldn't really hear her.
Okay. Can you repeat your question, ma'am?
Yes. I'm wondering where they got, where the Navajo Nation got the financing to purchase back the mine. I had heard rumors that they had taken a loan, that the company that was mining there loaned them the money to purchase the mine back. That's probably just a rumor, but I wanted her to share with us how the financing was arranged, because you seem to be familiar with it.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not sure how much of that is open public information. I'm sure that it is, but I just, before I speak out of turn and get in trouble, I want to make sure that it's full and open. But I can tell you that it was put together with a variety of financing packages. So
Excuse me.
A variety of different financing packages that was able to facilitate the purchase. And I think you're saying that the loan was given by the company that we purchased the mine from. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that was her question.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, I'm not 110% sure on that, so I don't want to give you incorrect information. But I would say, I'm going to give you my office phone number, and this is for anybody. Call my office at 202-682-7390, because I'd rather be positive before I give you incorrect information.
Can you put that number down, please, Linda? Cal, would you have a repeat that one more time?
Sure. That's 202-682-7390, and that's for the Navajo Nation Washington office.
Thank you very much. The other question that I had, Claire, if I may ask another question, is
sure.
You have staff that come down and that are, I don't know if they are, how they deal with some of these people that are coming in to develop, to make developments or to offer business opportunities. But I have had occasion to have one call me and invite me to meet with one of your staff. Or one of your staff called me, invited me to meet with somebody that wanted to do a business up there on the reservation. And I had no foundation on which, you know, how they were coming to me. And so I was confused by them coming and bringing the one that was that wanted to present the proposal to me individually. And so when they left, I realized that they were trying to solicit my support on a business proposal that was on the reservation, but out of the but one individual from that Navajo Nation, the Washington office, had come to solicit my support on behalf of this man that had come asking, you know, wanting to build something up there. And so, I kind of feel like that's not appropriate.
It's not, and I can guarantee you that no one from my office would have ever done that. That's not their role. They're in Washington, D.C. 98% of the time. When we do come out to the Navajo Nation, it's strictly to deal with government entities here in Winter Rock, usually, typically. So if someone presented themselves as being a member of the Navajo Nation Washington office, that would be incorrect, and, you know, that wouldn't be true.
See, that's why I was concerned, because I thought, oh, good, here's somebody that's standing, you know, representing us and coming, you know, to alleviate my, or to fill my questions or, you know, to give me answers. And when I saw him walk in with an investor or a developer and carrying a brochure of what they were wanting to sell me, I was dumbfounded. And then he proceeded, you know, to misrepresent some individuals that they had
had
coached.
Our office does not get involved in any sort of development or anything like that. And as for, like, one-on-one community outreach, that's not what we do either. So, you know, I would suggest if that were to...
You have different then there in the Washington office then? Different departments in the Washington office that represent different parts of the Navajo Nation government?
No, we interface with different pieces of the Navajo Nation government, but we do not do development. We don't do, you know, site visits typically out into the community. Our role is strictly government, federal relations, and liaison between Window Rock and in Washington, D.C. So I would think if someone was holding themselves out to be an employee of the Navajo Nation Washington office, you ought to get their name and report that, because that's not correct.
Thank you. I have been concerned with what I needed to do with that information. Thank you, Claire, very much.
You're very welcome.
Wow, that's... quite a variety of topics that we've covered. I hope you don't mind all the different things that I think most of them probably affects a lot more of a localized level than on a national. And we only have about 32 minutes here. I hope that you can hang in there with us, Clara.
Yeah, definitely. And I would encourage folks that have internet access to visit the Navajo Nation Washington office's website at nnwo.org. That's nnwo.org. We put out a newsletter every month that highlights what we're doing in Washington, D.C. You can also find out more information about the office and the staff there. And I would also encourage anybody that does make the trip to the nation's capital to please come by and visit our office, which is right on Capitol Hill at 750 First Street. When you go to our website, you can sign up for email updates, and you get emails from us on different things that are going on in the D.C. area that you might want to be aware of. You know, we try to keep people up to date, up to speed on everything that's occurring, including different summits and different events that are going on in D.C., or even hearings that are occurring on the local level.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that information with us. And so in terms of if we can get more information, and I'd like to kind of talk about the office itself. Of course, this office, you gave kind of the history of it for those. There's a lot of listeners out there who are joining us just barely now. And if you wouldn't mind, Clara, just kind of give a little bit, like a quick synopsis of your office again.
Sure. So the Navajo Nation Washington office exists to advocate for the Navajo Nation's official positions to Congress and various federal agencies. We're an intergovernmental entity that serves executive, legislative, and judicial branches. We're technically under the Office of the President and the Vice President, and that's how it was created in title back in 1983. And we've been operating since then with anywhere between 3 to sometimes 10 staffers. And then each staffer or legislative and government affairs associate tracks a different issue area. So we have one associate that handles all veterans issues, all social service issues, taxation issues, another that handles education, transportation, public safety, and so on down the line. And it's the responsibility and role of each of those individuals to track issues specific to that and to keep the Navajo Nation informed of pieces of policy or legislation that will impact the Navajo Nation.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, this office to me, I think, is it's absolutely vital from the federal government level that we have a nation who is willing to engage themselves on a national basis. So, having said that, how do you see, of course, we've got the National Congress of American Indian. They are a conglomerate of smaller tribes who basically have united under one banner to take on exactly what you guys are doing as a single office. And so how does that relationship work in?
That's a good question. We work quite closely with different entities, and there's National Congress of American Indians, there's National Indian Health Board, National Indian Education Association, National Council of Urban Indian Health. I mean, the list goes on and on, National Indian Gaming Association. All of these groups play different critical roles in how they interface with the federal government and agencies, NCAI, of course, being the largest of those. The Navajo Nation is a little bit different, where we are not members of NCAI as a tribal nation, but we have a lot of Navajo people that are individual members of NCAI, and there are a lot of issues that we care about, that NCAI cares about, and sometimes we're on the same page, and sometimes we're not on the same page, and that's okay. But it's important, in my perspective, to have the Navajo Nation there as its own entity, its own office, simply because of our size. You know, President Shelley always likes to say, there are tribes out there that are smaller than one of our chapters. You know, so why would we put ourselves in a situation where the Navajo Nation has one vote and a tribe of 600 people has one vote? You know, our issues tend to be a little bit different. They're more rural-based. We don't have urban centers. Our health care needs are different. Our transportation needs are very different. So that's the purpose of the existence of this office, advocate, not for billable hours, not because we're trying to make money as attorneys, because we make the same salary as any other Navajo Nation government employee. We're not in it for that. We're in it solely to serve the Navajo people. And as Navajo Nation government employees and not as private employees, it makes a difference. And it comes with its own unique challenges, but it also means that we don't have to register as lobbyists. And when you're a registered lobbyist, you have different regulations that you have to comply with that kind of tie your hands a little bit. But we're not lobbyists. We are advocates for the Navajo Nation government, and we're maintaining that government-to-government relationship, which is really important. And it's very fulfilling, and it's very rewarding, and it is challenging.
So I'm kind of losing the ideology here. Just kind of, what do you mean by you're not lobbyists, but you're more advocates?
Well, the term lobbyist is, we lobby, yes, that's an activity we do. But to say you're a lobbyist, you actually have to file as a federal lobbyist, and they have rules and regulations that they have to follow because they're lobbyists. And you probably see things like Lobby Reform Act or things like that, because you know, Capitol Hill really wants to ensure that people are being heard because of their constituents, because of their voting, not because of the size of their pocketbook. So when you're a lobbyist, you have to be very careful about how you're conducting yourself. And a lot of times lobbyists cannot be appointed. Well, it was recent with Obama. You could not be a lobbyist and go and work for the federal government and then come back and lobby and then go work for the federal government. They called that a revolving door, because you'd have individuals that would get inside knowledge about the government and then come out and, you know, make a lot of money as a quote-unquote lobbyist. But we're not lobbyists. And that's why I say we do lobby, but we're not lobbyists. We're advocates. And we always have to use that term.
Right.
It's a term of art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, on a federal level, from your office, you, of course, work closely with all the congressional, senatorial, or even the president's office. How often do you go down and see these senators or these leaders at a national level?
You know, it just, it varies. It depends on what's occurring at the time. But with a staff of, you know, right now I have 9 positions and different government affairs associates. So at any given time, we may have people on the Hill all at the same time in one day. So we do have to keep track of it. You know, so there are averages and things like that. And part of our role is we report back to the Navajo Nation how many times we've met with different individuals and how many times we've hit the Hill and things. So it just varies. It varies quite a bit.
What's your observation in terms of the congressional, senatorial, and as well as, again, the president's office, Obama's office? Are they very open to the Native people and their concerns?
I would say our delegation, meaning Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, they're very open. They're very used to dealing with Native people. Now, sometimes we're not dealing with our congressional delegation. We may be dealing with a senator from Missouri, for example, which has no tribes in their state. And in that case, it's an education process, and you have to educate them not only on tribal issues, but on large land-based tribe issues, which are very different. And with the 560-plus different tribes that are federally recognized in the United States, we all have very, very different needs. And I think a lot of times, congressional representatives, even agencies, they just want to put everybody in one box and say, you know, this is Indian country. But in reality, you know,
oh boy, it looks like we lost Ms. Clara Pratt. She was on her cell phone, and the service probably in Window Rock got dropped. So anyway, she was covering quite well there. So I am going to bring in Joanne back on. Joanne, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I just have another question again.
Joan, we lost Clara. It sounds to me like either her cell phone got disconnected or her battery died or something. But anyway, so I hope she calls back in. So we were talking about the Navajo mine purchase, and you had a lot of input where you're collaborating between the Navajo Nation office and also your area and chapter and all of this. You seem to have a lot of questions as far as that goes. So can you just give us some of your thoughts on this?
I have a comment. I have a question about credibility, the credibility of the people who advocate for our actual representatives. I just wonder how all of this affects everybody with what the decision was on Navy. I mean, the credibility of a lot of these issues that are put on the table, it's just like the confluence issue. We have the credibility to question the actual investors. You know, they have actual U.S. federal charges pending against them for embezzlement. And then we go and the Navajo tribe wants to give them $120 million to invest with them, and they have these charges pending. You know, where does that credibility stop? You know, where in our Navajo government is there a line where we say, you know, things need to stop? Now we have to question the credibility of the speaker, and then we're going to question the credibility of the actual council delegates, and then their fear of actually bringing him out of his office because of the charges, and then their fears of the charges that are pending against him, when in actuality, they, you know, the law says they have to uphold the law when they take that oath. And, you know, thinking about it, many of them were actually sworn in with these charges pending. Where does that put the Navajo Nation as they operate? That would question the credibility of the actual council itself and then the Navajo Nation government. You know, I wanted to know what what her take was on that and how that would affect the people.
Yeah, well, Clara is actually back with us. I don't know how much of that question that you heard, Clara. Welcome back.
life right out of the frying pan into the fire. No, I didn't hear anything, sorry.
Okay, I had a question about credibility. We have, like, all of these things that are put on the table at the Navajo Nation Council level. They just voted to remove Speaker Nazy, and they question his credibility as being a speaker. And then there's issues of the Navajo Nation Council delegates and their credibility and how that affects the operation of the Navajo Nation government and the belief that they're actually operating illegally. And then there's other issues of credibility as well as like the confluence issue and the investors and the credibility of the investors themselves, you know, the Navajo Nation wanting to give them $120 million of the Navajo Nation people's money. And then, you know, why is there no protocol that says this is what we need to do? How can we establish that, knowing that these are actual U.S. federal charges?
Claire?
Did you want me to speak to that?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
If you can.
Okay. Well, sure. You know, I'm a firm believer in innocent until proven guilty. That's just my belief, and I do believe in, I have a strong belief in due process, and I have a strong belief that, you know, people ought to be given the opportunity to defend themselves. As to the credibility, I mean, you know, credibility is extremely important. I would like to believe that our leaders that are in office are there because they were voted in because they were believed to be credible. So I think that what we have to do as constituents and as people who are concerned about the Navajo Nation government is to let the law take its process and to see if there is, in fact, any wrongdoing that's found, then we go from there. But in the meantime, I think rallying and calling for blood in the absence of any solid findings or any actual facts and charges, I think that's dangerous, and we ought to be very careful about that.
I think we have to question their initial plausibility, you know, and the premise of the whole situation. The general principle of law, you know, regardless of them being in position or not, they have to uphold the law before they can actually represent the people. So where does that put the people in all of this? Everybody's out, you know, wanting to get answers, and no one will answer any questions. And it goes back to, you know, the local chapter level all the way to the government level. These charges are really real, you know, and it's real money that's being taken, and the people are the ones that are being taken for. You know, there's no trust anymore, and there's no way to establish that trust.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and you're absolutely right. If there is a violation of law, then there ought to be removal. But again, you know, I just feel very strongly that until there is a violation of law, until there is a finding of guilt, then, you know, we do have a duty. We do have a process, and I think that we should follow that process.
Okay, that sounds good. Joan, thank you very much. So, Clara, now back to your office. I think those are, there's, of course, a lot of legislation that continually goes out there. Do you work separately for the various different departments on the Navajo Nation, or is it just one voice that is agreed upon in terms of something that affects the Navajo Nation, with whether it's health care or housing or what have you?
Well, it really depends on if it's an administrative issue. So if it's something, a matter of, you know, a public comment, working with the agency to implement rules and regulations, that's clearly an executive function. If it's a legislative function where we need an official Navajo Nation position on something, then we would work with the executive branch to ensure that we get something that's endorsed by the government proper, meaning the different branches. But for the most part, a lot of what we do is on the administrative side. However, we do work closely with the legislative branch on things that require an overall, you know, official position, if you will.
What's your observation in terms of the federal government? Do you really think that they, let's take, for instance, like President Obama. There's been a lot of advocacy on his part that the Native Americans, they have needs, they have wants, all of that, even filtering in on the Washington Redskins at one point. Do you really think that a lot of those, are they genuine feelings, sentiments, what have you?
Well, I should preface this by saying I'm quite biased since I worked for the Obama administration. So I think my response is going to be absolutely, they're very serious. But, you know, I do back that up with data, and I do say that under the Obama administration, we've seen more done for Indian country than we have in a very long time, not just Navajo nationwide, but just nationwide. The implementation of the Violence Against Women Act, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which extended, which authorized the Indian Health Care Act for the first time in, 12 years. The White House Tribal Nation Summit, which gets held every single year with the highest levels of government, with the administration, who then follow up, you know, one of the promise zones that he just recently announced being in the Chickasaw Nation. I think he's followed up his promises with very real actions that have come down. And we get to enjoy the benefits of being in on these very high-level meetings, including the establishment of the White House Native American Affairs Council, which I heard a lot of complaints about saying, well, there's no Native Americans on the White House Native American Affairs Council. Well, true, but it was meant to be the heads of the agencies that would come together and discuss Indian issues and Indian policy. That's huge. That's really huge. You've never seen that in any other administration since before President Obama.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I'm just absolutely impressed because, you know, you get two sides of the story, whether they're totally for Native Americans or against it, or if not, in a lot of cases, we get bunched into the minority issues. So that's good to hear. I'm just very, very, very pleased. Now, when we're talking about small business, which I really do appreciate you bringing up, and also just a sidebar, former President Zaw was also saying that small business is the backbone, and now we got Vice President Rex Lee Jim basically saying the same thing. So a lot of this business talk is starting to really resonate within the Navajo communities and, if not, Native American communities across the United States, which really gets me excited because, I mean, you know, I think the time has come when the Native Americans on an individual basis, we need to start turning this mentality from being employees to being employers. That time, I think we are ready because I've seen so many situations where people are really stepping up, and that's been very, very impressive, which leads me to this point, and that's talking about economic development. How, from a federal level, the federal government, you've got the Congress, you've got the Senate, you've got the President. From that level, of course, they issue a lot of financing, a lot of finances, whether they be in terms of form of grants or whatever that funding is. How do you think the federal government's role plays in the economy of the Native Americans throughout just whatever reservation? And do you think that they can play an integral role in economic development?
You know, that's a really good question, and economic development and small business development is something that's, you know, really near and dear to my heart. And I think you're right. We're moving into a new era of individual ownership. I think for a long time we've had what I would call, you know, a government-run economy, whether that's federal or even tribal, you know, with tribal enterprises being the answer. And I think we're getting away from that era. And we're saying, you know, that served its purpose and that was great, but the real strength and the real development of economy is going to come from our small businesses and our individual entrepreneurs. And the Navajo people and a lot of people are by nature entrepreneurs. You know, you just have to go out to the flea market on a Saturday to see the entrepreneurial activity that's happening. To go to your question about what role the federal government plays, well, you know, that's a double-edged sword. How much of a role do you want government to play? And I'm of the mind of take what is good for you, but don't ask for too much from the government because you don't want to be beholden. You want to develop a private economy. You want to develop something that's self-sustaining. And there are a lot of tools out there that the government, including the tribal government, offers to individual entrepreneurs. And there's a role there. And we've seen some of it through loan guarantee programs, which is great, micro-lending, CDFIs, things of that nature that really help to develop and spur what I would call a micro-economy, which to me is anything less than a $50,000 gross receipts operation yearly, which is the majority of small businesses. You know, small businesses aren't making hand-over-fist money. It's typically cottage industries, and those are the folks that we need to be focusing on getting capital to. And that's the challenge, is access to capital. And any role that either tribal government or federal government can play in assisting to access to capital is really critical, because whether a business succeeds or fails is, you know, it's a 50-50 chance in some places. And it's up to that individual, but we should be at least able to provide an environment where they at least have that chance to succeed or fail. And unfortunately, because of the way that land is status in Indian country as trust land, it's really, really hard. I mean, I know so many people that would love to borrow money for a home or borrow money for a small business, but they're on trust land, they're on a home site lease, and it's not easy to collateralize that. Whereas if you have a place somewhere else, you can take a mortgage out against it and use that capital to fund an education or fund a small business. And we don't have that same opportunity on the Navajo Nation in a lot of parts of Indian country. So we need to think of diverse tools and ways to get money into individual people's hands so that they can have a crack at what everybody wants to crack at, to making it and doing something for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad that you bring up the issue about the, not the issue, but just the dynamics of the Navajo Nation enterprise. And I wholeheartedly do agree with you. These enterprises, the ideology behind why they were developed, yes, they've run its course. And now the time has come when a lot of this business development ought to be privatized. And I talked to the folks from InTech, and in those questions, basically my position has been, how much is the Navajo Nation looking at bringing in the private sector into these businesses? And so that's, you know, that's good to hear. And basically what I was, you know, which you alluded to was the Navajo Nation, and as well as the federal government. I've always said that a government should not own businesses, whether it's a federal government, state government, or tribal business. They ought to be there to facilitate. And how do we get that mentality? Because I know what happens in Washington, D.C. today is really going to happen about 6 months from now, or vice versa. There's always the pre-planning. There's all sorts of what they think I'm doing. And a lot of it empowerment to the native tribes. Do you think that, I mean, this is what I'm getting at, is that do you think that the Navajo Nation and, or if not the federal level, are they looking to privatization, or are we going to stay within these, what's already been established?
Well, you know, I think that depends on the industry itself. In the instance of NTEC, you know, when you have the nation being the financier or being the investor, it makes sense in a specialized industry like NTEC. I mean, where on Navajo are we going to say, hey, you run this mine? That's not a real tall order, and especially in regards to a natural resource that we're just now saying we are going to run this natural resource, our natural resource, we're going to do it ourselves. So NTEC, I think, is a very specialized industry that would be not impossible to privatize, but hard to privatize and keep it Navajo-owned. However, there are ways that we can incentivize research and development on the Navajo Nation so that we make that an end goal to say, okay, NTEC is tribal enterprise right now, but how do we look to maybe privatize it? How do we look to make the Navajo people the direct shareholders, not through shareholder representatives or government entities, but how do we make people, individuals, shareholders in companies. And then I think you can incentivize enterprises that serve a specific niche function like NTEC. You can incentivize them to subcontract with locally owned businesses. So they don't need to develop their own fleet management. They can contract with an individually owned Navajo company that does that, or they can contract for their graphic design. They can contract for these things, which I think is an important way to foster development and foster private businesses.
Yeah. Well, Clara Pratt from the Navajo Nation Washington office, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. We have about 5 minutes, and I'd like to give you this opportunity for you to share with us whatever you want to say in closing, and to the Navajo people, and again, all the listeners, thank you so much for dialing in, for your questions. I am a total advocate of having open dialogue, and I think this is a great opportunity. We're going to have more guests like Clara, and I'm sure I'd like to have her back again. And so, and we have the Navajo Nation Washington office, 8:00. So, Clara, I will give you the last minute and a half for you to give your closing statement. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate the time that you've given me today, tuning in and listening. Again, please visit us at nnwo.org. If you're in Washington, D.C., please come by and visit us. I get homesick, so I love to see people from home come and visit me. And I just really appreciate the questions, and we spent a lot of time on local, domestic issues, and some time on D.C. issues, but I think there's a lot more dialogue to happen, and I really appreciate everybody's thoughts and concerns that were shared with me today, and I always welcome dialogue, and again, please visit us at nnwo.org, or if you're in the Washington, D.C. area.
And give us your telephone number.
Yes, telephone number is 202-682-7390.
Okay, thank you, Clara. You're going to be right back with us, right?
Oh, I'll come back on any time. Yes, sometime in the future. And if people prefer email, you can feel free to email info@nnwo.org.
Okay, thank you very much. So that will conclude this segment of the discussion. And again, I'd like to thank Ms. Clara Pratt for being with us. And we have some more exciting shows scheduled for you next week and, of course, the future. And again, thank you. I'm so absolutely glad that the word business is filtering out there. I'm just happy about that. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. And I will talk to you next week. Okay, Alana.
Online, on air. Online, on air. Online, on air. Online, on air.